This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Thank you for coming out tonight for what is a very, very important conversation. We, of course, see the importance of dealing with homelessness and with housing shortages throughout Southern California. And yet it's not even simply a California issue. This affects us nationally and calls into question policies that we've historically had on the federal level as well as here in California and in Southern California counties. We are not using a formal debate structure tonight because of the complexity of the topic and all the different facets. We thought it best to instead have a series of questions which our panelists are going to be responding. You'll meet them a little bit later. And to go through some of the biggest challenges that we face in wrapping our arms around homelessness and the shortage of housing. You know, here in California, the state has spent over $20 billion in the last few years. And yet the numbers of people living on the streets and in their vehicles has not subsided. The question is, what do we need to do at a policy level to find some way of making success and helping the lives of people that are really struggling? Now, we chose to start with Jessica Castillo as she has firsthand experience with housing insecurity, and she certainly knows well as a student here at UCSB the challenges in the Santa Barbara County housing market. So we're going to be hearing about her experiences growing up in Hollywood, as well as since her time here arriving at UCSB. And this helps kind of ground our conversation. Jessica, thanks for kicking off our conversation this evening.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with your experiences. You were sharing with me that your parents, when they arrived in the United States, they were like so many other immigrants, found it extremely difficult to find a place to live and to really settle. When you came along, what sort of a housing environment did you grow up in?
Yeah, so again, my name is Jessica Castillo. I grew up in LA, raised and born, or born and raised, actually, not the reverse. So like Larry said, my parents were homeless when they arrived to the United States. Luckily, they were able to find housing, and I had housing growing up, but it wasn't the most safe and secure housing. I had siblings that came along, grandparents in a one-bedroom apartment that my mom could afford, and they've been living there for the past 30 years, and the numbers has basically stayed the same. And rent has risen there, and the reason I say it wasn't safe and secure for me was because I was abused. The situation has gotten a lot better, I will say, with time and therapy and such, but that is a privilege to be able to reconnect with my parents and go through therapy and such to go back to my family and find it be safe and secure now.
And share what it was like to be in an environment where, you know, you're going off to school each day, you're having to study. Obviously, you're an outstanding student because you're here and you're on the verge of graduating. What was it like for you to carve out place for yourself, to do what you needed to do to be able to advance?
For me, school was my safe haven. I got myself into sports and clubs, but that didn't go well with my parents. I would come home and it would be violent, I will say.
They wanted you at home instead?
They wanted me at home. They wanted me to do the chores, take care of my siblings because my mom would work overnight. I didn't know where my dad was. So, yeah. Yeah, I would basically come home to violence and go back to school and do it all over again.
So you're totally caught where you need to be out of the house.
Yeah.
To do things for yourself, mm-hmm. and yet you're punished for doing all those things to help yourself.
Yeah.
So how did you process that as a kid?
It was really hard. I will say, as a kid, I thought it was normal to have such a violent household. I thought it was normal for my parents to punish me over the simplest things, to get angry at me all the time. It wasn't until I would say I graduated high school and arrived to college in my dorm that I had so much anxiety. I had insomnia. I had all these nightmares. It was so weird to be an individual in a safe space, but feeling like you're being watched. There's always something that you're gonna do wrong and you need to be punished for it. It's a weird feeling, and it disturbed you in an academic sense and also mental. I did not want to get a job. I had worked since I was 4 years old. I just wanted one quarter where I could actually focus on my studies. Yeah. And there was still such a mental toll on me.
What did you find when you arrived here at UCSB, which of course has legendarily difficult housing? Mm-hmm. Did you have a place when you came as a freshman?
I had a place my first quarter, and then I had to drop out. I could not afford my second quarter of housing, nor my third. I dropped out, and it was right before COVID, so I guess eventually everyone left, but I had dropped out, and so I wasn't enrolled in UCSB compared to my peers who were still enrolled, but they could do remote work.
Yeah.
And so I fell behind in school. I took on full-time work, but I was missing my academic career, and I was back to that unsafe housing.
So what enabled you to find a place here and to get back into school?
I actually visited my two old roommates, and seeing them do their work during summer at this point, so they were still doing some remote stuff, and I remember going back on the train, seeing what they had and how happy they were, and I remember just sobbing on that train. I missed it. I missed, because growing up, college was everything to me. And it was the one thing that my parents really pushed through, especially as an immigrant family, to be able to be the first one to succeed and get to higher education and get that degree. It's a lot of pressure. And so I just remember bawling in that train and thinking, I need to go back for my mental health, for my future. It's what I want and it's what I needed.
And so did you move in with your former roommates? Was that how you worked that out?
No, actually, they already, so here comes the housing crisis of Isla Vista. I got super lucky because I enrolled back in and I was told that I was back in May. Mostly all the time, students here find their housing during winter quarter, like very early. And if you don't, it's like really hard. You'll see hundreds of Facebook posts asking for roommates. And the only reason I found roommates was because I had a friend of a friend who was becoming an RA, and she needed to sublease her housing, and it luckily worked out, but that's also a privilege to be able to work out things with new people, because I can only imagine meeting someone through Facebook and then living with them, having no idea if you're gonna connect, the dangers that might come from it. I've seen that happen, where someone has to move out because their roommates are, they can't, for multiple reasons, but I was super lucky to find housing.
Yeah, and once you came back, did you feel as you thought you would feel getting back into the classroom and your studies? You feel right again?
I wish it was that simple, because I remember first day, my cats kept me up because they were at a new place, and I remember thinking this might have been a mistake. I was scared. I was uncomfortable, and I grew comfortable at my old job and being at my old place, because even though it was unsafe, it was all I knew, so it was comfortable to me. But I got my GPA back up, and that was it. If I can do this, then why can't I do it again?
And then you moved into helping other students who were housing challenged as well, which is probably most students here. Mm-hmm. So what have you found in that time, the things that are most effective in helping pairing a student with a place to live?
I would say really hear them out. I am grateful that UCSB is a great institution where people can get involved, people can get resources, and the resources I would say are accessible, especially as a US-born student. I had financial aid, I was able to apply for CalFresh, and there are so many others, like a laptop grant. I wouldn't have passed any of my classes
without
my laptop.
I didn't know there were laptop grants.
There's
laptop.
That's great. You can rent iPads now.
That's terrific.
You can rent iPads.
That's great.
But yeah, there's just always all these growing programs. I mean, we have transitional housing now, in which a student who may not have safe and secure housing can stay for free, have a meal plan, and housing for about 30 days, all free. But obviously, that doesn't solve everything. So I guess that leads into my job, in which I'm, like what was said before, I am one of the Rapid Rehousing Pilot Program interns, in which my job is to fill in the gaps in between the UCSB resources already available. So like I said, transitional housing, 30 days might not be enough for everyone. It's already hard to go back into housing. It's hard to accept that you need help. It's so hard to find a job, especially that can work with your school hours, that can pay enough. And so we've come up with a program that just launched actually recently, I want to say this week or last week, in which there's security deposit grants. So students that show financial need and already in transitional housing can apply and get a grant.
So they don't have to come up with that extra money at the front.
Yeah, because rent is one thing, but security deposits, it can be up to like twice your rent.
Mm-hmm.
Or like first months and last months. Like that's a lot.
And how many people have that saved up?
Exactly.
This obviously is very rewarding for you because you know what that experience is like. That's terrific. Thank you for sharing the experience, Jessica, talking about the work that you've done, and congratulations on all the hard work that you've put in. It's great to hear what you've done.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Jessica Castillo.
Thank you.
And now we're going to introduce our panelists joining us this evening. Let's bring up our guests, starting with Eric Tarz, who's Senior Policy Director of the National Homelessness Law Center. He helped spearhead the center's Housing Not Handcuffs campaign and has served as counsel of record for multiple precedent-setting cases. He's a frequent media guest on programs like the one I host and in national publications, Eric Tarz. Rashida Phillips is the Director of Housing at PolicyLink. PolicyLink is a national research and advocacy organization. It supports racial and economic equity. Rashida leads PolicyLink's work on tenant protections and land use. She's worked in the area for multiple legal services and nonprofits, as well as being an attorney. She's an interdisciplinary Afrofuturist artist, which is one of the great titles. She's exhibited and performed around the world. I want to see your work sometime, Rashida. Love that. Octavia Butler's someone I knew, and yes, I knew Octavia because she's a Pasadenan, so where I do my show. David Garcia is the policy director for the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley. He leads the center's work with governmental housing policies, focusing on research-driven ideas to reduce barriers to high-quality, affordable homes. David's frequently quoted in major publications and heard on radio all the time, including my program. Thanks so much, David. And Andy Bales was, until retiring just a few weeks ago, the president and CEO of Union Rescue Mission on downtown LA's Skid Row. He led the faith-based shelter for 20 years, and he fought the governmental and hospital policies that led to the dumping of patients with no home address on the streets of Skid Row. This was a scandal in Los Angeles, where hospitals would just have a vehicle come pick up the person that they didn't want to keep in the hospital and take them and just leave them in Skid Row in terrible conditions. So Andy has had an up-close look at suffering and what's arguably the nation's most graphic example of visible homelessness. Andy recently moved to Des Moines, Iowa, where he serves as executive director of the Children and Family Urban Movement and joins us tonight. Thank you all very much. So let's begin with the question that frames the night and philosophically where each of you are in your expectations of government. And the question that frames all this is there a right to permanent housing, regardless of someone's ability to pay for it? And if so, what does that right mean? Does that mean providing an apartment for a person to live solo? Does it mean dorm-style living with multiple people sharing a unit, a shelter bed in a safe, clean environment, or something else? Or do you take the view there's not a right to anything? Charitable groups can come in and help and ameliorate, but there really isn't an inherent human right to housing. Let me begin with you, Eric, and very briefly, how you see that question. Is there a human right to housing?
Well, first, thanks to you for moderating and to the university for hosting us here. I think 100% yes, there is a human right to housing. As part of every person's inherent human dignity, they need that housing to be able to fully realize their full human potential. And you know, there's a lot of hesitation around, well, if we have a right to housing, what would it cost? But I think the flip side of that is, what does it cost us when we don't have the human right to housing? And we see that all around us every day. We see the tens of thousands of people on the streets of California. We see one-third of Californians paying more than half of their income in rent every month, putting them just one missed paycheck, one medical emergency away from a slide into homelessness. And it also means that they can't take the time to invest in themselves, in their families, in their kids' education, in their communities. And so those costs add up. And we see that when we don't have adequate housing for people who are living on the streets, communities end up criminalizing them, arresting people for the crime of not having a home, and then they're paying thousands of dollars a week to keep them in jail when that could be paying for a month's worth of rent. So what we want to do is, if we want to see what the right to housing looks like, we look back in our own history. This is not a foreign concept, but back in the 1940s, President Roosevelt declared, we have a right to housing, and every American should have that right to a decent home. And when they have that, that's actually what unleashes the potential. That's what lifted a whole generation out of the poverty of the Great Depression, and then led to the greatest generation and their ability of families to invest in themselves and their communities.
You're talking about the GI loans, is what you're talking about.
Yeah, GI loans and so many other ways that our country subsidized and invested in the suburbs as well as in the in public housing.
All right, yeah. Hold that thought, please. We'll come back to it. Yep. Rashida, your answer to the question.
Yes, thank you so much, and thank you again for having me. I'm going to have to agree with Eric. I believe that, yes, it is a human right. And I'll say that for two reasons. One, again, echoing Eric, right, that housing is intrinsically linked to human dignity. It's not just about having a roof over one's head. It's not just about the physical location, right, but it's about being able to provide a stable base from which people can pursue all of the opportunities that they need in life, whether it's education, health, being able to engage in other meaningful social and cultural activities. And so having that secure, adequate housing is the thing that will enable people to exercise the other fundamental rights that they have, whether it's a right to privacy, whether it's a right to speech, a right to pursue happiness, right? It's all of these things that are wrapped up in the concept of home and housing. So it's not just about that physical location. And the second reason why I believe that, right, is because if one takes the social contract theory seriously, right, right, that posits that the government exists essentially to ensure the basic needs of its citizens, to ensure that those basic needs are met in exchange for that governance. And so that contract implies that it is the government's duty to protect and ensure access to essential needs, which includes housing. And so that responsibility, it goes beyond shelters. It speaks to that ability to maintain access, affordable housing, and to be able to have stable housing. So I would say it's not just about shelter, right?
You anticipated my question, okay.
Yes.
Yeah, so it goes beyond shelters. Is dormitory style living multiple people, or do you think that what that right means is that everybody has a right to their own private, personal living space?
I believe it means everyone has a right to adequate housing that is stable for them, and I think that is different for every community. I think it's going to look different for every community, every city, every town. It depends on the type of issues that they're seeing. It depends on what's available. So I can't answer that question specifically except to say that it is up to the community, but it should be adequate and it should be stable.
David.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having us. And I would say we're three for three, because I'm also going to agree here. I think there is no question in my mind that housing is a human right. When you think about the bare bone basics that humans need to thrive, like Maslow's hierarchy, like shelter is right up there with all of the other things that we take for granted every day and really should underpin any decent society, would be the ability to provide that basic right to individuals. Housing underpins really everything else in our lives, right? It's one of the biggest determinant factors of whether or not you are healthy. It determines your success later in life. And basically just your ability to thrive as a human starts at being able to have a safe and secure place to call.
So what does that mean for you though, specifically?
Yeah.
What is the level of that you think is the bare minimum for government to provide people?
That's a hard question to answer because I don't think there is one solution in the toolbox, and I think it probably needs to be a lot of things, and we need to be honest with ourselves that we have such an incredible deficit of housing, and not just housing available to the most vulnerable populations, but across the spectrum of housing in general, right? So it could look like, and we're going to talk about some of these models later, like Housing First. It could be emergency congregate shelters. I think we have to look at all of this stuff because it is a bit of a continuum of shelter depending on people's needs and where they're at in life. But to a greater point, like I think when we talk about housing as a human right, we can't talk about providing that right unless we talk about building housing in general. Right, and so much of where we find ourselves today is a symptom of our inability to build housing across the income spectrum for not just years, but really decades.
And we're going to, as you well know, we're going to get into that later, and I'm really interested hearing, based on your experience at the Turner Center, talking about some of the ways you think that can be accomplished. So we're going to be talking about providing more housing starts as well as shelter for people. Andy Bales.
Thank you. Thank you, Larry. Thank you, University of California, Santa Barbara, for the invite. I would have to say the right to housing as currently being carried out by national government, state government, local government, especially California, especially LA, is not being carried out in a way that is possible or affordable or it's a myth and a fantasy that we will somehow build very expensive, slow to develop units with a granite countertop for everybody experiencing homelessness. Shelters, immediate welcomes, innovative housing, transitional housing, innovative, affordable. I went to the governor and I said, why did you spend $22 billion on housing and you've got nothing to show for it? Homelessness has increased. Street homelessness, 47% in California since that was done 10 years ago. And overdose deaths have increased 77% on the streets because of the choice to help a few with very slow to develop expensive housing while leaving tens of thousands on the streets with no immediate relief, no shelter, no focus on recovery. the way it's being carried out, and it's the philosophy, this philosophy of housing as a human right that led to their misconception that that means everybody deserves a very expensive unit with a granite countertop. We can't do that. We can't do that. It's an unsustainable plan. We have to have a segment of our society that we believe can make comebacks, right? That we believe people can recover, people can bounce back, they can get training, they can return to the job and become productive community members. And our current way of carrying it out is all wrong, and California is the only state that doubled down on it, and our overall homelessness skyrocketed. We have half of the U.S. street homelessness in the country on the streets of California. We have one-third of California, one-third of the U.S. homeless are in California.
Let me throw this out, and whoever wants to jump in, I think one of the concerns that I've heard expressed from members of the public about, and we'll get into what the housing first model is, but the idea that everybody, the goal is to give everybody an apartment who doesn't have a place to live. The problem is you've got beyond, say, in Los Angeles, where 55,000, I don't know what the latest numbers are living on the streets or in cars. You've got people that are staying on cousins' couches, that are in converted, these are people who are in very insecure kinds of environments, but have found a way to sort of patch together a place, you know, a safe place to live far from ideal. If you're going to extend and say there's a right to, for everybody to have a place to live, and that's a single apartment for everybody, well, all the people who are sleeping on couches, all the people who are in the garage, all the people who are crashing in their parents, well, I can get an apartment. That's going to be more than 55,000 people. So if you really follow to its logical extension, what's offered in this, how is this even possible? Can you tell me how that could be possibly done?
I'll jump in. I mean, it's going to be a variety of methods, as David was saying earlier, that, you're going to first, I think one of the challenges with housing first is that correlation is not causation. It's the fact that homelessness has increased while housing first has been the primary approach doesn't mean that housing first has caused that homelessness. That homelessness has been caused by a deep dearth of deeply affordable housing and the fact that we used to make sure that everybody got a housing subsidy who needed one. Right now, only one out of every four Americans who need that subsidy is actually getting it. That means three out of four who need it aren't getting it, and they're ending up on their cousins' couches and their cars, et cetera. And so if we can address that inflow into homelessness from those highly unstable renters or folks who have already lost their own secure place, then that diminishes the number of people flowing into homelessness, and we can then use housing first to get those 55,000 off the streets, and that's where we have to make more of an investment there so that there is an adequate place for all those people to go. But it doesn't all have to look like a new unit built for each person. We have tons of housing out there, tons of vacant units in Los Angeles that are being held vacant for profit when there are tens of thousands of people on the streets.
But one of the things I hear a lot in the conversations that I have with people who are homelessness advocates is that, well, we can't do congregate living situations because who would want to live in a dormitory-style environment? Or who would want to be in a... It's all sort of... Everything points from the advocates that I hear from toward the apartment given to someone. That's the goal, is that the government provides the apartment. And I understand you're saying they're all different solutions, but I don't hear advocates talk about dorm style or congregate or you know, turning warehouses that are sitting in used into places with cubicles for people. I don't hear that. Does anyone hear that argument being made to do that?
Radical housing first harm reduction folks get upset that you're only spending $15 per bed in a sprung structure when that $15 could have gone to one of our buildings. And a friend of mine in the Midwest has I won't say what he calls the HUD group, but you can imagine when he's opening up 50 tiny homes, 350 square foot with a bathroom and a kitchen on 21 acres, the group comes after him, both with the newspaper and funding, and tries to tell him, we're going to get you because you don't deserve any of this government funding that's flowing.
Yeah. Any of the other, Rashida, yeah.
I might suggest that maybe y'all are just talking to a narrow set of people who may have one perspective. I mean, I think I hear all sorts of conversations about the different tools, different models that are needed to come together, and it is not just one model that folks need to rely on in order to start to resolve this issue. And so, you know, just as Eric suggested, there's lots of reasons why folks end up homeless or unhoused or inadequately housed, and there's lots of different ways to address that. It's not all about building and building more, right? In some ways, it's about preventing people from falling into these situations. There's a whole, you know, whether it's economics, right, in terms of folks not having adequate jobs to be able to pay the rent that keeps rising, and then they end up evicted or they end up, you know. So there's all sorts of tools, and it's not just about building, I think, and it's not just about how many units do we need, right? It's about how do we preserve what's already there? How do we keep people housed who are already housed and prevent them from becoming unhoused or inadequately housed? So I think that the conversation is broader than what might be being presented here, what some folks might hear in their own different spaces. But from the perspective of someone who's at a national policy organization who talks to all types of advocates across the country who are trying all sorts of different things, I think the conversation is much broader.
So are we seeing congregate places being built, and how is that going? Is it creating problems, or is it working? What are we seeing? If there are places open to doing this, how is it working?
So I might turn to Eric for that, because I am not the homelessness expert on the panel. I'm the housing expert.
So, I mean, you have to imagine, like, what would you want for your own mother, brother, sister?
This is where they go.
Yeah, is it appropriate for some people? Will it reduce harm for some individuals to get them immediately off the street into a congregate living situation? Sure, but is it appropriate for a person with disabilities who can't get up to the top bunk? You know, we've seen, and the real threat comes when people who can't access shelter because of any of these barriers are criminalized in their community for not being able to have a place to sleep. And so that gets them into the jail system. It's a huge misuse of resources. So the model is about getting people into a place that's actually appropriate for their needs.
But I mean, if you ask where would I like my mother to be, of course I'd like her to be in some luxurious, you know. So I don't understand how that's really relevant. The issue is what are taxpayers really going to be willing to provide to people realistically, and what can we fund? And so I wonder, are there places in the country where you've got dormitory style and you've got, you know, single people without families living in there, getting job counseling, and that being okay? Or is the goal we got to get everybody into an apartment?
I think that's what the right to housing, fully adequate housing, is a place where you can fully realize your potential. And so, yes.
How is that possibly affordable? I mean, how many billions of dollars would that, because everybody then comes off the couch, everybody comes out of the basement. If that's really what government's going to provide, how in the world can you do that?
Right now, we are already paying more than that in jails.
But you're not paying for the people staying on the, you're not, there are so many more people who are in less than satisfactory living circumstances. Those don't get counted. So when you're looking at the money, well, people in jail and people on the street, you're not even counting all that population. And if that is the goal, if we say housing is a human right, and the goal is we're going to move everybody into an apartment, yeah, how does this other than a lottery with winners and losers?
Larry, use LA as a case study, right? 50,000 people on the streets, they pronounced that they're going to meet that need by building 10,000 units 10 years ago or 8 years ago. So far, of those, I just looked at the latest serious results. So far, 8,900 are underway in some way. 14% are livable, you can move in. 53% are still in construction, and 32% are being pre-developed. So to meet a need of 50,000, LA decides to build 10,000 units, which was one fiftieth of the need, or one fifth of the need?
One fifth.
But they've only gotten done one fifth of one fifth. And they've left tens of thousands of people on the streets, and these expensive, slow to develop housing units. And you can read the LA Times articles. I'll quote a couple of them. The LA Times didn't listen to me for 9 years. They ignored me. They were the publicists for Housing First and Measure HHH, and I kept after them. They finally investigated, and they say it's subpar, it's crime-filled, it's chaotic, the elevators don't work, and a man was quoted as saying, "This first time in my life I felt subhuman." So the model we have of the Housing First, right to housing in LA is let the drugs freely flow, create a subhuman living environment, and leave tens of thousands on the streets. This is a myth.
Okay, well, let's talk about Housing First, because we keep going to that. So Housing First is the view that really before people are going to be able to address whether it's mental health problems or addiction, they need to have a safe place to live. They need to get off the streets. They need to get away from the vulnerabilities there, have a way to be safe in their own person. So then they have the ability to commit of their own choice that they're going to get sober or they're going to take advantage of mental health services that are offered. And the view is if you try and coerce people to do it, or if you make housing conditional on people getting into a program, it's not really going to work because people have to make a commitment to do it. You can't pressure people to do it and get positive results. They'll go for a little bit and it's not going to stick. So you've heard Andy talk about his concerns over what he thinks happens when people are moved into units with no conditions put on them whatsoever. But are one of you an advocate for the Housing First model?
I'll just say that what Andy has seen in LA is an example of Housing First not done well, but that doesn't mean that we fault the entire model for it. That where we've seen adequate investment in the supportive services that go along with Housing First does not mean housing only. It means those voluntary services are also offered, and where adequate amounts of investment in the actual infrastructure are made. We see places like Finland, where homelessness does not exist. You can't find an unsheltered homeless person on the streets. And if that's what we want to see in America, like they show a real great model of how Housing First, they stepped up, they made that investment, even though it cost a lot of money, but the results are something that we all want to see. We all benefit when people are actually indoors.
But here, and Andy's got the expertise, so he can correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is in Southern California, we have a very high percentage of the people that we see, a visible homelessness, who are either addicted or are dealing with severe mental illness, and or both, and they exacerbate each other. And one of the problems is trying to get that perfect connect of the house and the supportive services, because as you know, we have a tremendous shortage of mental health professionals. So you get people into a house and then there aren't enough people to provide. So that kind of coordination that Finland does, and I don't know what percentage of their people who were unhoused are dealing with addiction or mental illness, I don't know. But you know, here in California, that's proving incredibly vexing. How do we fix that?
And I mean, I would say on the flip side of that, is a congregate living environment really the best place for people living with mental health disorders?
Well, that may be less dangerous than having an apartment. Yeah, because they're in a congregate setting, they don't have the degree of security, yeah.
So I want to jump in on a couple of things here. So we actually have a lot of good quality research done on the effectiveness of Housing First. So through randomized trials, we know that when done correctly, Housing First is a significant, shows a significant reduction in people falling back into homelessness. So there has been work done in Santa Clara County that found that Housing First, individuals that are offered Housing First, between 80 and 90% of them did not fall back into homelessness. It's not just there too, they've done this across the country. We've seen similar research results.
Do we know what percentage of those people were dealing with severe mental illness and addiction?
I don't know that number off the top of my head, but I do want to dispel a myth in that people who fall into homelessness do so because they are drug addicted and because they have mental issues. Many of the visible homeless individuals we encounter on a day-to-day basis may be suffering from that, but the vast majority of people do not enter homelessness with those challenges. And so just to be clear about that, and so when we talk about Housing First as a model, it is, I think Eric made this point really well, is that we see a lot of Housing First implemented poorly and not funded correctly and not provided the right services for people. When it is done correctly, which is expensive, let's be upfront about that, it is a great reduction in homelessness. And we don't need to look at Finland. We can look at other states outside of California that have done this, other cities. Think of places like Houston, which have effectively eliminated homelessness over the course of just a few years. And the key with addiction as well is you see states like West Virginia, which has significantly higher rates of drug use than California. They do not have a homelessness problem like California does. So for me, I go back to the cost of
living is a fraction of here.
Because they have housing. Because they have enough housing to meet the demand of people.
There.
Housing is cheaper there, and so people can afford it. So let's make sure we understand the link between the availability and the cost of housing and the amount of homelessness we see in a community.
Now, you said that the overwhelming majority of people who we see on the streets were not addicted, were not with serious mental health challenges before, that this has happened in the time that they have been on the streets. Maybe you can explain a little bit about, because my understanding is that people don't just go right to the street when they lose a place to live. If they have a car, they're staying in their car. If they have family members or friends, so many people say, come sleep on the couch till you get, they don't just go from losing their job and can't pay the rent to they're on Skid Row. So something's...
I think that with a broad brush, though. I think
you think
every,
that does happen a lot?
I think for every family, it's a different circumstance. It's not a... You can't really say there's a percentage of people who get to have cars and sleep in their cars, or there's a percentage of people who have that may be true, but it really depends on the individual. Each family's going to have different circumstances. You have folks who get evicted all the time. They may not have a car to go into. They may go straight into the shelter, or they may actually end up staying on the streets. So I think you can't paint a broad brush to say that most people do this or most people do that. It's a really complex and entrenched issue. And I agree. I think most of the people who we see on the streets, we can say, okay, they look addicted or they have mental health issues. A lot of people are on the streets because they were evicted. And these are people who had housing, who then became unhoused and who...
And who went directly there. I didn't realize there was a high percentage who went directly to the streets. Andy?
Don't miss this. California is a mess because it's only carrying out Housing First and the federal policy and the state policy that homelessness will bring drug addiction, and you cannot intervene in any way in drug addiction. So you cannot even offer an AA meeting or maybe go see a counselor. They're following it to the letter of the law, but the law is from Washington
so wait a minute,
to
they
the
can't,
state.
That doesn't make sense. People can't be offered services?
No, they can't be intervened and told your living is in jeopardy. I'm a common sense guy from Iowa. When I did permanent housing in 1990, before anybody ever even heard of it, I would tell people, you can bring a beer back into your apartment in a brown bag, but if your drunkenness spills over into the hallways and into public, we're going to have a talk because you can't do that. I evicted my own brother for driving drunk on his motorcycle and tearing down the fence. So that has all changed. If I, as a contractor, want to offer housing in family housing, I have to sign the harm reduction model that I won't intervene in drug use on
so it's our, unconditional
in
housing,
our family
yeah,
housing.
Did you want to come
our transitional housing? Hang on. One more point.
Okay.
A guy named Chris, who runs a great program, Solutions for Change, he said, I was ready to sign on the dotted line today, but I was told if I take government money, I have to allow hard drugs to freely flow in my building, and we're just not going to go there. I'm not going to go there with families. Union Rescue Mission is not going to go there with families. I grew up, I'm probably a little sensitive to this, I grew up with a brother addicted to drugs. It's violent. He would bring hardcore armed drug dealers to our house, and I'd call him over trying to warn him, David, do you know who you're hanging out with? And he'd say, guys, my brother wants to know who I'm hanging out. Put my life in danger. Drugs are violent. We are by policy in America inviting violence into affordable, permanent supportive, affordable housing units. And I've seen it all over the country.
Okay, but you know, what the counter to that is that if you don't use a harm reduction model, and the idea is you're not trying to you know, get someone off of drugs, or that you're trying to give them the safest possible environment without intruding on their rights.
Right.
But the argument is that so many people aren't going to take advantage of the housing if you put terms and conditions on it, and they're going to continue to live in a dangerous circumstance.
San Francisco just had 71% of their folks living in permanent supportive housing vote that they want sober housing. The people themselves living in housing want sober living. At least present it as an option. We've done a one solution, right? We've done the harm reduction, free flow of drugs in the whole model. Let's at least have some recovery.
Okay, Eric, you were gonna say something, I thought. You were gonna...
Just to say that it's not that you can't offer the AA meetings and the other services, it's that you can't condition attendance on the ability, on their rent, on their housing. And we know from lots of research that recovery from addiction is not a linear process. And so if every time you have a relapse, you get kicked out of your housing, you're gonna fall a lot further than if you have the stability of housing, if you know, you know, that you can stay there and then you can pick things back up again and move forward. So,
hold that up. One of the concerns that we've had is with some, again, in the Los Angeles area, that there have been nonprofit operators who have come in, taken over buildings, created safe, nice places for people to move into. And because of the problems that they've experienced with the tenants that are there, destruction and damage and fires that are set and unsanitary, they have not been able to stay on, they can't stay on top of it because the problems are so numerous that it, and so it's ended up with a lot of units that can't be occupied because of this, families that are unhoused or afraid to go in and use the facility. So what is the answer to that? If we follow this idea of harm reduction and we can't put any conditions on any of this, how then do we make these livable spaces?
Well, we can adequately fund and resource the staff to staff them, and we can make, you know, it doesn't mean that we can't have different kinds of housing where some of them self-select and say, we want to have a sober living environment, and that's the rules for that community. But if somebody, you know, violates that again, that shouldn't mean that they lose their housing permanently. There should be another place where they can stay in housing, even if it's not that housing.
Okay.
So I want to also be clear about something too, right?
Yeah.
I think we're in this caricature of a permanent supportive housing place where there are no rules and anything goes, where you...
It's not a caricature if you're, in your life in L.A.
If you are in a unit that, or in a property, and you are a danger to tenants, if you are destroying the property, there are terms that you have in there that actually, you know, can lead to the removal of that person. If that person is a clear harm to neighbors and other individuals in the building, like this is not, it should not be, right? If something is properly run, it should not be a free-for-all, per se.
So, yeah, and I don't know whether it's just spending the money to evict the person. These nonprofits are already financially strapped. I don't know, because, you know, in Southern California, at least in Los Angeles, quite a laborious process to evict someone. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that's the reason why, but, I mean, the Los Angeles Times has had multiple stories on hotels that have been, adapted reuse for these kinds of facilities, and this has been an ongoing problem. I do want to talk about ways that nonprofits can have a greater role in this, and you know, what are some of your thoughts about public-private partnerships to create housing that's heavily subsidized, if not free, that can actually get more housing starts? You know, given the cost of units, like in Los Angeles, where they're spending $700,000 per unit, there's got to be a way to do this. I know housing costs are expensive, but
innovation.
Yeah, what?
My buddy's probably going to spend less than $80,000 per unit, 350 square feet, bathroom and kitchen, mobile home. I forgot.
I think we're having a little trouble, Andy, with your microphone. Can you turn your tie a little bit? Yeah, that way.
$22 million.
Yeah, there
you
we
could
go.
Buy 825,000 mobile homes and end homelessness in the U.S. for what we've spent in California. And if housing's the issue, there you go. That's 825,000 units with $22 billion. You got to start spending smarter. You got to do innovation and mad 3D printed concrete homes that take hours to build. You can build for 82,000 a unit. Container homes, prefab homes, and I would prefer in recovery communities, but that's what they're doing in Austin, Community First in Austin. It's what they're doing in Des Moines. We've got to think differently than everybody deserves their own shell
yeah,
to live
so,
in.
So, David, share with us some ideas similar to what Andy is talking about that can get the costs down and leverage some private investment as well.
Yeah, so Andy makes some really good points. There are a lot of things that happen that are really promising, right? So things like manufactured housing can be provided quickly and at a much lower cost than a new permanent supportive housing unit, right? So you mentioned $700,000 for a new unit in Los Angeles. I mean, in some parts of California, we're talking about $1 million a year.
Yeah.
And so that there's a, and particularly in a budget-constrained environment that we are in now, we do need to look at things like innovations in construction technology, but also per zoning, where are we even allowed to put these things, right? So we haven't even talked about pushback at the local level for building any kind of housing. But to your question about innovative models, you know, I've seen some interesting groups out of Los Angeles that are using partnerships with the Public Housing Authority in Los Angeles to take vouchers and actually create deeply affordable units, pairing that with property tax exemption, to do this all through traditional kind of debt and equity projects, so not taking the traditional low-income housing tax credits or state subsidy dollars and actually building homes that are affordable and that can be built at much lower cost than the traditional LIHTC, low-income housing tax credit project, is built at. And so that to me is really exciting because it doesn't rely on existing scarce subsidy sources and it leverages the general power of the market to actually deliver something that is affordable, which is not something the market is typically good at, but we are seeing some signs that we can maybe do that.
Well, that's great because it seems like what we see is construction at the luxury end because the cost is so high between land acquisition or adaptive reuse of a building or dealing with environmental remediation. All these things are so expensive. That's great if they can find ways. Rashia, what are some of your thoughts on how to do this?
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what David said and also, you know, just the fact that we need to get more innovative, more creative. So things like tax credits, looking at zoning reform, right, to be able to build different types of housing, mixed income housing, right? But again, I want to emphasize that I don't think it's all about building. I think it's also about protecting what's there, preserving what is already already existing, right? So that means changing and building in protection so that tenants aren't being evicted and becoming homeless, facilitating policies that allow for community ownership, that allow for tenants to be able to buy their buildings back when, landlords are selling those buildings. So these are all emerging policy areas that I think also support, the homelessness crisis and the lack of housing out there. And then also thinking about things like other models like social housing, models that are successful in other countries, but that are also emerging here that allow for permanent affordable housing that is permanently off the private market, that folks can afford, that's environmentally sound, that is adequate, that is stable. So I think we need to get innovative and stop being scared about some of these models that seem foreign to us, that have these words like social, that get people a little scared, but right, that really are...
That usually means taxes when you're talking. So is that what it means where social is used, this tax dollars that funds that?
No, not in this case. In this case, social is really about, yes, right, we want to see, I think in a lot of these models, having the government own that housing is probably what folks want, and what feels best. But I believe in private-public partnerships, and I believe that the social is more about we all get an opportunity to access that housing rather than it be about who's paying for it.
Yeah. So I think that some people call it social housing. I think there are other terms, but it really it's just government-sponsored housing that can create, lasting affordability. And I think when you said, it's tax dollars, not necessarily. There are some really good models. So the New York Times had a great story on the model in Montgomery County in Maryland, where the housing authority there has essentially become a developer. And so they are building new housing there that is indistinguishable from new market rate housing that has a mixture of middle income homes and lower income homes. And so they're able to make that math work so that they don't need direct subsidies. It's just because they own the land, they're able to leverage that and create new homes that again, as Yoshida said, they're in public ownership in perpetuity.
This is not like the historic housing project that we think of a government apartment building. It's not like that. These are single family homes you're talking about?
No, they're apartment buildings.
Oh, they are apartments, okay.
But their housing does.
And they can.
Yeah.
Okay.
Single family
okay.
homes. There's different types of models, absolutely.
Okay, yeah, Eric, comes through. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say that when you talk about the tax dollars going to it, we have to ask ourselves, where are our dollars going right now? There used to be tax dollars going to support public housing in this country, and we did not have mass homelessness. Those tax dollars were given back and are flowing now to billionaires, and we see huge wealth inequality in our country, and the result of that wealth inequality, the result of the tax dollars that haven't been coming in to our coffers since Reagan cut the HUD affordable housing budget in half back in 1980, and we've been failing to build and maintain the public housing units that we've had every year since then has put us into this affordable housing deficit. So if we can rebalance that, and again, this is coming back to the topic of the debate, is housing a human right? Having the human right to housing, like in a bill that's right now in the California legislature, ACA 10, would actually create that obligation, a duty on the government to make sure that everybody is adequately housed. And so we have a right to property right now in the Constitution, but if that right to property and to profit off of that property interferes with another right, like the right to housing, then there has to be some sort of intervention.
But isn't the right to profit from property at the bedrock of development of housing? Isn't that essential to create the profit motive? To create the overall housing stock, doesn't that need to be there?
No. not if the government says that it's actually
a duty.
Well,
we'll take over housing and just the government builds all housing?
It can exist side by side with market rate housing. It doesn't mean you have to do one or the other, but where that right to profit is interfering with the rights of millions of Americans to enjoy safe, stable housing, there has to be some sort of balancing of those rights. And so what we see, for example, in California right now, there's this a law that says if you can't, every community needs to make a plan on where you can site a homeless shelter. And if you don't make a plan for where that is going to be, then it can be anywhere that's the default, rather than it's going to be nowhere. And we can do the same with affordable housing. We can say the default when every community says, I don't want affordable housing in my backyard, is that no affordable housing gets built. We can flip that. We can put incentives in place or disincentives in place so that that housing will actually get built.
Okay. I guess, and maybe I'm not on the point that you're making, but I wonder if you're going to be taking much of the profit out of housing, because this idea that it interferes with people's rights to have a place to live, how do you end up with other than corporately owned housing? Because you need mass scale to deal with the inability to evict or people who aren't paying rent. If the government's not going to fully subsidize and make the owner whole, which it's hard to imagine they really do that. So how would then, you know, so much of our housing stock in California, the rental stock, is mom and pop landlords. Would there be any place for those people under the kind of model you're talking about?
Of course, yeah.
How did they sustain, though, the losses that would come with that? If the tenant's rights always supersede the landowner's rights, how is that workable?
It's a kind of community-held right. So we're looking at the need to create enough affordable housing in the community so that everybody can afford the rent. And we don't have that now. And what we see is people unable to afford their rents and becoming homeless. And so it's going to put some safeguards in place so that affordable housing stock, which isn't getting built right now, gets built alongside those existing rental units. It doesn't have to replace them all and become a monolith.
Can I tell you the reality?
Yeah, Andy, yeah.
So in LA, the Measure HHH money showed up, the Measure H money showed up, and city councilmen, county supervisors, others, they picked out the sites for the developers before any of the invites for a grant or anything came in. And then the developers got paid up to $7 million for the development fee on the affordable housing, permanent supportive housing. And then the city councilmen got kickbacks from those developments. And three or four of my former buddies in the city council are now serving federal prison time. That's the way reality works in LA. So when you're talking about all this stuff working out the way it should, we've got a long way to go with integrity in government, ethics in government, doing things correctly, focusing on what's good for people. We're just nowhere close to doing it right.
And I just want to mention, HHH is a city of Los Angeles bond measure that was passed by voters to create. How many units, Andy, were promised?
Said they were going to do 10,000.
Okay.
When the need was 50,000, and they've got 14% ready to move in.
So that's
8 years later.
There was a separate measure H that was
H, yeah.
There was an LA County measure, and that was to provide supportive services
which
for
never
people
came.
Experiencing
which
home.
Which never came. I don't know where the money went. As Eric asked, where
okay.
did the money go?
Well, supposedly they were going to do an audit. So at some point, hopefully, we will get that. David.
One of the issues with HHH has been that while there's now this big pot of money to build supportive housing, there at that time was not the same will to overcome local opposition to where that housing should be sited. And so part of what was not anticipated but probably should have been was that people were not going to be okay with someone building a shelter near them. And so at the same time that we were thinking about allocating resources, we need to think about the other policy levers we need to be pulling so that we are using those dollars effectively and actually getting these units built. I think we so oftentimes just think of the dollar number and think, you know, in good times in California, that's an easy sell. But at the same time, we are not seeing the numbers of units built for the investments that the governor has made, for the investments that the voters have voted for. And so it's not just about the money. I mean, you can't build without it, but you also need to think about all of these other things, the zoning, the permitting times, the fees, all of the stuff that adds up, that adds cost and time to build anything, not just supportive housing or shelter housing, really housing across the board. And so much of that has not been addressed head on.
Neighbors don't need protection, but I'll give them some. They don't want the free flow of drugs moving into their neighborhood. They don't want the policy either. That is their big concern. And you got to understand that when you move in a place that has a lot of chaos and trouble into their neighborhood, they are going to react.
But you think, Andy, so even if it was a sober living arrangement,
no,
that they
if
were
it
required,
was sober, they'd love it.
You think neighbors would accept that?
We've
really?
Been accepted. Hope Gardens were loved by the neighbors.
So I want to push
Angela's
back on this.
Angela's House immediately accepted into the neighborhood because they knew we were going to hold people accountable, we were going to have security, and we were going to have sobriety. Union Rescue Mission could move anywhere in LA without much opposition because we hold people accountable and we believe in sobriety. People welcome us.
David, and then Rashida, I know you wanted to make a
Yeah. So I don't think it's so much the case that it, the way that the housing is run completely kind of minimizes the risk of having access to drugs. If you have what's supposed to be a sober living situation, you may still have forces outside of that kind of tempting those individuals who live there.
Presumably, you'd have more leverage to evict people if they violated the policy.
So one thing I want to touch on here is that Andy is describing some like really awful situations that are clear examples of a poorly run model.
But that seems to be the norm.
Yeah, I don't think it is the norm.
That's what we see
so
in
when
Southern
we California. When we talk about these things in San Francisco, we have navigation centers or emergency shelters. And part of getting these things sited, which is no easy feat, even in a place like San Francisco, the groups that put these up, they have to invest a lot of money into making sure they have security and so that the neighborhoods that they are locating in do not fall into the situations that Andy is describing. So like that needs to be a part of this.
And I'll come back because I want to talk about getting some of the impediments to development, particularly affordable housing, and get your take on that with your expertise. But Rashida, I want to.
I think I just wanted to strongly disagree that people accept housing more, building housing more when it's not drug, has these conditions related to drugs, or that people would be willing to accept a sober living place in their communities. I think decades of housing discrimination has showed us that people do not want apartments, they do not want multifamily living, they do not want people of color often living near them, and I think we have a lot of evidence to show for that people don't want any type of housing that is not single family owned housing in their communities.
Of the composition of the current community.
Yes.
Yeah. Eric, were you going to say something?
I'm sorry. The same thing, that like it's not that even in those places where it's just we want to build affordable housing, there are a lot of prejudices and stereotypes.
It's going to ruin our neighborhood.
It's going to ruin our neighborhood based in, overt or covertly held prejudices about who lives there and saying that they're going to bring crime. These are just people who need affordable housing. And I think it's a real danger, again, to talk about the minority of people, the highly visible minority of people who need addiction and other services, when the vast majority of people experiencing homelessness don't have those addiction issues. It's the majority of people you see because you perceive them as homeless.
Well, or just people that work at homeless services, a lot of volunteers. The people we talk to that tell you the overwhelming majority of people have serious either psychological or addiction problems who come in the door.
But there's so many people out there, the people who are living in their garage
or their car,
who you don't perceive as homeless because they are doing everything they can to not let you see them as homeless.
And but of course, if you factor those number of people, were many thousands more than the current census.
Right, but they need the housing too.
Okay. I wanted to ask you, David, so you were mentioning all these impediments to building. We have CEQA in California, which has become kind of a pinata for developers' rights folks. So what do you think would be the way to really, get more starts of affordable housing into our communities?
Oh, man. We only have, what, like, how much time left? So there are a couple places I start. You know, there, we need to change where we're allowed to build housing, and we need to rethink about what that housing looks like across the spectrum of housing typologies. I think so many times when we think about building housing, we think about tall, you know, towers or buildings that are out of scale with the neighborhood. But so much of our housing stock is single family homes. Something like 90% of all land in a given California city is dedicated to one housing type. Now that's not necessarily bad per se, but if we don't allow other housing types in these places, we've artificially constrained where we're actually allowed to build housing, and that is reflected in the high cost of land and the really limited opportunities to build housing of any kind, is particularly for affordable housing, because they have to compete against market rate builders for really prime pieces of real estate. So that's the first piece. And then the other piece is just making it less expensive to build. In California has the most expensive development ecosystem in the country. And so we mentioned this earlier, but in some cases it can cost $1 million per unit to build deed-restricted affordable housing. That housing is high quality and it's needed, but when you scale that up to the need, like there's no way we can actually afford $1 million per unit. So thinking about ways that we can bring the cost curve down through things like innovations in construction technology, through thinking about making it easier and faster to build, because in development, time is money. If you have certainty in the development process, you can get cheaper financing, you can build faster and avoid the impacts of inflation, and you can bring down costs that way. And then, you know, a lot of this has to do with just the current, the market itself, right? Right now, California used to build 300,000 homes per year in the 60s and 70s, and even into the 80s. This most recent boom in the housing market was only 100,000 per year. So with many times more a higher population, we've built just a fraction of the homes that we used to build. And so this is not like an audacious goal. The state of California used to do this and do this quite regularly. And so
we did a lot through sprawl, though.
We did a lot through sprawl.
Which is now looked down very negatively, the idea that you're moving out and building new suburb upon suburb. That's where a lot of that single family development happened.
A lot of that development happened in the 90s and the 2000s, but in the
back in the 70s, and I mean, at least in
sure, we had the GI Bill, Levittown, all that stuff really exploded the single family market. But at the same time, in the 60s and 70s and 80s, we were building almost equal amounts of multifamily housing to single family homes, and that is because it was allowed per zoning rules. But because of a lot of the issues that Rashida mentioned, cities proactively downzoned so that in communities where you might see a lovely four-unit building that was built in the 30s, it's illegal to do that today. In so many of our communities, we've made it only the single-family home is allowed to be built, and a lot of that was for very pernicious reasons. And so we need to rethink how we approach land use from that perspective, but also we need to just think about how do we do this across different communities. California has something called affirmatively furthering fair housing. So affirmatively furthering fair
Got
housing.
It. Okay.
AFFH. It's easier to just use the acronym.
Use the acronym.
Yeah. And so the challenge has been that a lot of cities have gone through this exercise per state law to say where they're going to build housing. And they always, for years, have said, we're gonna put it in this part of town where we know it won't get built, or we know that the people who will live there won't interfere with our existing neighborhoods, right? And so that changed with the passage of AFFH. And so cities now have to think creatively about how do we facilitate the creation of housing across the income spectrum in different parts of the community and not concentrate poverty or multifamily homes.
What about adaptive reuse? And Rashida, I don't know if this is something you maybe talk about as well, but what I hear so much from listeners, whenever we talk about housing issues, we have all these vacant, fill in the blank, certain types of buildings. And I know sometimes it's more expensive than to build something new, but your thought, are we underutilizing buildings that could be converted to housing?
Yes, we are.
So what are the hurdles there?
Well, I mean, I would say probably the profit motive, right? People, looking at a place where I'm from, Philadelphia, right? We have lots of empty downtown office buildings that came about during the pandemic. There is now a move by the new Philadelphia mayor to get people back into work offices and get Center City back up and running to where it used to be, even though that's not practical and it's not what people want. And you could take those homes and, those places and readapt them to housing, but there's not the political will. And there is more of a profit motive, you know, get these developers in, get them building luxury housing, get the city back up and running in this sort of way. So I think that's at least one of the barriers that I see in a place like Philadelphia,
yeah.
But it may be similar in California.
And I know it is expensive because you've got perimeter windows and how do you make the units where, you know, how do you get light in the center of building? But there are creative ways, I think, they found to deal with that. Eric?
Yeah.
I was just saying, at the federal level, there's a program that's been really underutilized. It's Title V of the McKinney-Vento Homeless Assistance Act, which says that the federal government needs to make available vacant federal properties to homeless service providers free of charge in order for them to provide services or even to provide housing. We got that revision into the law. But the way they've set up the financing structure for it, you have to have your financing set up before you can get your plan approved, but the financing needs the plan to be approved before they'll give you financing. And so we're kind of caught in this.
So how do you get your plans together without financing?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So if we can remove some of those bureaucratic barriers, those regulations are being revised right now, and this could open up huge amounts of housing, super low cost to service providers, and actually get some of these units being built in places where they're desperately needed.
So Larry, I think you asked.
Yeah, David.
Well, I think what I heard was kind of a specific question of, you know, we have a lot of vacant, like privately held office buildings, and can we just turn
even
those
some of them are
into
publicly
housing?
Held,
so, yeah, there's public
yeah.
ones too, and I think a lot of cities in California are trying to think creatively about making those available for affordable housing developers too. But the vast majority of those empty office buildings are on the private market. And I would say, I wouldn't characterize it quite as the lack of profit. It's just it doesn't make economic sense for the vast majority of these buildings to be converted into any kind of housing. And
it just is too difficult.
So a good rule of thumb is when it was built. If it was pre-war, the floor plates are shallower. You have light walls already. Those can be converted at a lower cost than, say, your 80s office tower that has these gigantic floor plates, to your point, no light in the middle.
Yeah.
That is, it turns out, really expensive to do.
Okay.
And so some cities have been able to successfully change some of this, though, but it didn't happen just by the market working. They had to offer some incentives in order for those projects to take hold. So in Calgary, they created a property tax incentive program where they abated the taxes for a number of years if developers were able to turn an office building into housing. They've done this in Cleveland, they're doing a lot of this in New York, and in California there have been legislative proposals to create similar incentives to get developers to actually turn their office buildings into housing. And part of that has been paired with a mandate or requirement that at least part of those units be held at affordable rates too. So I think, yes, we have an opportunity to reposition these empty towers, but it's not just gonna happen on its own. We need specific policy action to actually make it work.
And Rashid, I wanted to ask you, because you do so much work in racial and economic equity, how do we need to incorporate that, in your view, into this? Or is it, does that by definition happen because we're dealing with communities in need? Or are there specific ways that we bring that to this development of affordable housing?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's a complicated one. I think in some ways, yes, by virtue of understanding that the people who are most impacted by things like homelessness and eviction and housing instability are people of color, are black and brown people, by virtue of addressing these with different solutions, you are addressing that population. But for me personally, you have to do that more intentionally. You have to do that with a specific race equity lens, and that means also including the people most impacted by these things into the conversation to understand what those solutions are. And so in some ways, right, an audience like this, or even us panelists, right, we are not the people experiencing this. And so a lot of what we're saying, right, we leave a lot out of, in terms of imagination, innovation, what is possible when we don't include those people. So that's what it is for me. And just like to name what we're dealing with here, just a couple of stats, right? In America, we're seeing over $10 billion estimated total rent debt, nearly 5 million households behind on rent, 5 million children in households who are behind on rent. And 66% of those folks are people of color. So we do have, you know, a very stark racial equity issue when it comes to these things. And so, yes, we do need to deal with that intentionally and not just passively by saying, you know.
Yeah, yeah, the rising tide will lift all boats. What about specifically with evictions? Because there's so much debate about, well, what's the best way to protect the rights of renters but not depress the development of rental housing by making it too onerous for owners. What do you think are some of the principles that you think, or even specific ideas for helping to keep people from being evicted, but not penalizing property owners along the way?
Sure, I mean, I think there's lots of solutions out there, right, that don't overburden either side. There are, and I can name some protections, right?
Yeah,
for example,
please, yeah.
Things like right to counsel for tenants. When landlords, you know, and tenants have that relationship breakdown where it does end up in court, I think often we think about these cases as being about money or the tenant's automatically in a wrong. But just like anything else, these are really extremely complex situations that people are in. And so having a right to counsel, right, in a system where most landlords are represented across the country, about 80% on average landlords have, lawyers walking into court, and only 2 to 5% of tenants don't, you see an extreme power imbalance, and you see a lot of things play out in that place where, again, people fall into these cycles of homelessness. They fall into a cycle where they are evicted, and now they have an eviction record, and now that record prevents them from being able to access safe and affordable housing into the future. So something like right to counsel, it just gives both people a right to have their day in court and to be able to bring defenses, which is something that people don't always have, the ability to do. Something like just cause eviction, a protection that says that the landlord has to give you a reason why they're evicting you based on a list of reasons. They can't just evict you for no reason, right? That gives a tenant an opportunity to know that their lease is on the line, to sort of try to work it out, to move to another place without becoming homelessness in between, right? So I think when we can think about tenant protections as something that it doesn't impinge on a landlord's rights, it just gives them the opportunity to have an even playing field when in terms of entering a contract, so that contract, a lot of times these contracts are what us lawyers call contracts of adhesion, where, you know, the terms are so abstract or they're just in some cases illegal, and you have a tenant who has a little power just signing a contract, and it could say anything, in terms of putting them out. So just fairness, bringing fairness in a way that doesn't impinge on anybody's rights. Everybody maintains their rights, but there's fairness, there's transparency, there's an opportunity to work out things before someone becomes unhoused. One of the things that we were able to do in Philadelphia, we have a right to counsel for tenants. We also have an eviction diversion program that happens before a case gets filed. So that way a landlord and a tenant have an opportunity to go and try to have a mediation, to connect automatically to the rental assistance portal. You know, it's a common application, so that if it is about money, you have the money right there when you're trying to work it out. You don't have to wait to get into court, get a record, you know, get kicked out, and then all of a sudden you're...
Are other cities doing that, do you know?
Yes, there are other cities doing that and exploring these programs, and particularly during a pandemic, there was a lot of opportunity with the federal funding that came down for folks to try to explore these different innovations alongside a moratorium. So it wasn't just stop paying rent, stop evictions, right? There were these other sorts of programs that were interconnected with these things so that there could be a sort of holistic approach to how people resolve these issues.
And how did the tenants and the landlords respond to this mediation, this pre-eviction? Has it been well received?
It has been. It's seen very big success levels in terms of landlords and tenants accessing the program, and it's reduced the eviction numbers, the number of cases that get filed in eviction court because of that. Yes.
Very good.
And,
go ahead. Yeah, Eric, go ahead and then David.
I was just going to quickly say that, and this is an investment, it certainly costs some investment to provide that lawyer, but in every place that they've done this, they found it's reduced costs overall because it's so much easier to keep a person in housing. It can cost, $500 of unpaid rent. But then that person stabilized and they stay in housing, as opposed to they fall into homelessness and then it costs so much
more to get
them out.
Yeah, that really makes sense, because you're making that one-time investment, making sure can they find a resolution, then avoiding all. David, I'm sorry, and then I want to.
I was just going to really honestly just say the same thing, is that emergency rental assistance was, in some respects, a big success story of the COVID pandemic response. So many people were able to remain housed and landlords be able to get back rent through rental assistance programs. And I think that's a lesson we need to take moving forward, is that it does not take that much money to keep someone housed one time because they had a hospital bill or their car got into an accident. You know, the cost to society is so many times greater.
Yeah, their business closed. Yeah. So COVID gave us Zoom and it gave us rental assistance. Yeah. So at least we got a couple of good things despite the tragedy of COVID.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.